Greetings to all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph. We're today in lesson 340, and we're about to read now about the children of Israel who are now at this point southeast of the land, way down under the Dead Sea, below the Dead Sea, and below the Dead Sea Edom was, and so they are even below that, trying to enter into the land through that territory. Actually, they wanted to go through the territory of Edom so they can go up further up where it's easier and from there cross over into the land. And the king of Edom was not about to let them do it. And so this is what we read here. And that's in essence is another chapter among many of the history of Jacob and Esau, his brother, that is their descendants obviously, which still continues to this very day, of love-hate relationship, of mostly conflicts and animosity and envy and jealousy and oppression and bloodshed and war, and there is an awful lot of that. And maybe sometimes later on when we have time, we're going to take some time and go through the history of Edom and Jacob in more detail in terms of prophecy to this very day, that we've done quite a bit of that in the past. But obviously there is still much more to it in history, and also future biblical accounts. But at this point, we see now Jacob, who has been separated in essence from his brother Edom. Geographically, he went into Egypt. Edom remained in the land, in his own territory that God gave to him, Mount Seir, which is right below the Dead Sea. At the time, that area was still very fertile, and later on it was cursed, as we read in Malachi chapter 1, where God cursed his land. And that happened later on, when he began to fight with his own brother again, and obviously God was not about to bless him for that. Now, up to this point, he's still in a very blessed land, a fertile land, a good land. And Jacob, through the person of Moses, is asking for him to allow him, you know, he's requesting, in a very gentle manner, to enter through his land into his own land, and Edom, true to his own nature, he's never willing to do that. And so we read here in verse 14 of chapter 20, and Moses sent messengers from Kadesh unto the king of Edom. Thus says your brother Israel. So he's reminding him who Israel is, and obviously Edom knows. But you see, he's approaching him in a brotherly manner, hospitable manner. He says, you know all the travail that has befallen us, how our fathers went down into Egypt, and we dwelt in Egypt a long time, and the Egyptians dealt ill with us and our fathers. And when we cried unto the Lord, he heard our voice and sent an angel. And mind you, who is that angel that he's talking about here? We went through that a while back, the angel of the Lord. That's the one he's talking about, the one that appeared to him in the bush, the one that was in the cloud, you see, and the one that became later on Jesus Christ. And so oftentimes he's called the angel. In other words, his identity has always been revealed there from the beginning as one who is being sent by somebody else that was the Most High. And so for people who later on became blind, who were not blind earlier in the Jewish community but became blind, as we read in Isaiah chapter 6, that God was going to blind them, take away much of the knowledge and understanding they had, and the ability to see, to perceive, to understand, to hear. And of course, they're not going to acknowledge that. You see, blind people, spiritually, they're not going to acknowledge their blindness. They like to think that they're still wise. And so, when they advance this concept of the monotheism, it's not biblical. It is not a biblical teaching, monotheism. In other words, one God, period. You see, now only one God dealt with them, and all the other gods were idols. From that point of view, you have monotheism, but it's not a true monotheism. You see? Because this God that dealt with them, oftentimes, made it very plain to them that he was sent by somebody else. You see? But when blindness and the veil was placed upon their eyes, well, this is basically what happens. That's why when you come to the New Testament, you still see the same thing. There is only one God and one Lord. What does it mean, one God and one Lord? You see, first God does not appear in the Bible anyway. That's a modification of a German Gott, you see. And when I say one God, one Elohim. In other words, one Most High. That's in essence what they want to trying to convey. One Most High and one Master. The Master of all, you know, humanity, the Creator of humanity. You see? But both of them are divine beings, so the same nature and character, and the same power and glory. And when people become blind, obviously they're not able to perceive that anymore. So this is another case here where you see it. And that's what Moses tells people, and people knew that. Not only Israel knew about these two beings, but other nations did know about it too. And so this is what he says to Edom, and this is recorded, and Edom received this message, and Edom, you know, is not confused about who is this angel, because Edom knew that. His father met this angel before that, wrestled with him, and this angel told him that he is the God of Bethel. So this is not ignorance or blindness. The world at the time was aware of that, you see. It's the world later on in Jewish history, as time went by, and later on even the people of Ishmael, like Muhammad, he too totally lost his knowledge and understanding as time went by, and that's why they came up with the monotheism that they have today. And there is only one Allah and that's it. You see, they cannot conceive of Jesus Christ, the Messiah, as being a divine being, the Creator, and also Elohim. But the time will come when all are going to see it plainly, the veil will be taken, and then they will say, oh, wow, okay, that's what it means. You know, at that time they're not going to be bickering about it, or having contempt for it, or speaking evil of it, or blaspheming. You know, when the eyes are open, you see and you acknowledge what you see. That's basically what happened to all of us when our eyes were opened. And so this is what he says here. He heard our voice speaking about the Most High, because he too was dealing with humanity. As Christ made it very plain, my Father works as I see my Father doing, you know, works, I work too. You know, as he resurrects the dead, I do too. So he's acknowledging that his Father, though he's not dealing personally with humanity, he's involved. You see, a lot of people don't realize that, how much the Father is involved with his creation. And so he said, in essence, the Most High, speaking about the Father, the one that became known as the Father later on, he heard our voice and he sent an angel and brought us forth out of Egypt. And behold, we are in Kadesh, a city in the uttermost of the border, that is, southern part of the territory of Edom. Let us pass, I pray you, through your land. We will not pass through field or through vineyard. So you're talking about a land here that was fertile, that had fields, farming area, and vineyards. That's not desert. Neither will we drink of the water of the wells. So it had plenty of water, plenty of wells. We will go along the king's highway. We will not turn aside to the right, nor the right hand, nor to the left, until we have passed your border. So he's asking for passage through the land of Edom, going all the way up around the Dead Sea, you see, so they can enter, in essence, the land right there near Jericho. And so this is what he's saying here. And that's an area right above the Dead Sea. And he said, this is what we'd like to do. We're not going to harm your land, and we will not turn aside to the right hand nor to the left until we have passed your border. Now, what's the reaction of Brother Edom? Hospitality, remembering that this is his brother, you see. Now, the two brothers finally reconciled, you see, and for a while, you know, things were okay in that family. But as time went by, the descendants of Edom, they concentrated only on the afflictions that their brother, that is, their father had, because he lost the birthright, and all the bad things that, you know, from their point of view, that Jacob had done to him. And they totally forgot brotherhood, and to this very day they still function in that manner. They forgot the brotherhood. As later on, we hear God accusing Edom through the prophets, that he had forgotten, the book of Obadiah, you see it in Isaiah, in Ezekiel, that he had forgotten the brotherhood. You see? And that's what the children of Edom were doing here. They couldn't care less, so this is their brother. And, you know, in modern terms, just like, let's say the Canadians, you know, want to pass through the United States so they can go on the way to South America, whatever, for whatever reason. And the American people just forget the brotherhood between them and wouldn't let them go through. Well, this is what, in essence, what is happening here. And so Edom said unto him, You shall not pass through me, lest I come out with the sword against you. That's the nature of Edom to this very day. And what Edom, of course, Edom doesn't know that he is Edom today, either in the Middle East or in other lands where he went, wherever Jacob is, this is where you find Edom on the border. And they don't know that, and they still have the same nature and character, the men of violence, men of bloodshed, you see. And to this very day they display these qualities, and they don't realize what their fate is going to be, at least on a temporary basis in terms of this side of the kingdom. Or in essence, God said that he's going to make Edom a desolation. And only very few of the people of Edom are going to be remain alive when Jesus Christ returns, because of the violence, as it said in Obadiah and other places, against your brother Jacob. He had no mercy, especially in the day of his calamity. And they're going to be partakers of the punishment of Jacob when the time comes, and they're going to do it with joy, spiteful joy, as God calls it. And unfortunately, that's the nature. The people of blood, they love blood. And that's what God tells them. You're in Isaiah 35, 36. As in Ezekiel also, as you love blood, you see, he says, I will give you blood too. That's your nature. And this is what he says here. They didn't come to fight against him. All they asked, please let us go through. All they had to say, if you don't want to, okay, I don't want to. But to threaten war, you see, to come with a sword to spill blood, innocent blood, well, that's totally uncalled for. But unfortunately, that was the nature of Edom. And that's the reason why God said in Malachi, Jacob I loved. Jacob was not a man of war. But Esau I hated. He hates that spirit. He hates me, a man of violence, of wrath, of fury. You see, inhospitable people. That's a demonic spirit when you think about it. And he abhors that. And that is for any human being on the face of the earth who is of that spirit, not only the people of Edom, even when the people of Jacob have that spirit, he abhors that and hates it. And so the children of Israel said unto him, well, he's still pleading, Moses and the leaders, we'll go up by the highway. And if we drink of your water, and I and my cattle, then will I give the price thereof. You don't even need to be hospitable, we'll pay for it. Let me only pass through on my feet. All nations of the earth, they encourage tourism, and if you come and pay and you send their hotels and all that, they're more than happy to have you there. And here, they're offering to pay for all that, like tourists. He's not willing to do even that. So he's not willing to accept them as brothers and give them the hospitality you give to a family member. And he's not willing even to accept them as foreigners in terms of strangers and tourists. You see? That's how evil was the nature of Edom. And it's going to cost him an awful lot because of that. And so, this is what they're asking here. And he's not willing to do even that. He said, we'll just go through and we'll pay for whatever we use. Let me only pass through on my feet. We're not even going to be riding on horses, It's not an army. There is no hurt. You see, we're not going to harm anything. Walk on our feet. And he said, you shall not pass through. And Edom came out against him with much people and with a strong hand. So, all of Edom with their swords, they were ready to do battle. With people who were just asking, let's just go through. We're willing to pay for hotels and water and utilities, whatever it may be. That tells you an awful lot about the nature of Edom and why God hated that spirit that was in Edom. You see? And why God cursed Edom. And he called him the people of my curse. You see? And to this very day they are. They're subservient to Jacob in many places, wherever they are. And God does not allow them to become great success. And generally speaking, though now and then, in order to spank oftentimes Jacob, he allows them to rise up for that purpose, and then he brings them down again. And this is what's happening here. And so, we read in verse 21, thus Edom refused to give Israel passage through his border, Wherefore Israel turned away from him. So this is recorded in history. That's a part of the history of Edom, and it's going to haunt them forever. In that sense, when they're going to remember what kind of people they had been to their brother, and people would read it and they would realize, why is it that God is going to punish them so severely like no other nation on the face of the earth? Even far worse than he punished, or he's going to punish Jacob. And so this is what's going to happen in the future, and this is basically background to that. And so Israel went away from him. Well, they're not going to fight him, even though they could, you see. But God forbid them to harm their brother, and yet their brother was not mindful harming Jacob, if he could. Verse 22, and the journey from Kadesh and the children of Israel, even the whole congregation, came unto Mount Hor. So they went around. And the Lord spoke unto Moses and Aaron in Mount Hor by the border of the land of Edom. So they came to the border but did not go through Edom. And he said, Aaron shall be gathered unto his people, for he shall not enter into the land which I have given unto the children of Israel, because you rebelled against my word at the waters of Meribah. So he's reminding Aaron, and he's the first one to go. Moses still is needed as a leader of Israel. And you can see the penalty that God was exacting on his own servants. Here it is, the high priest. You see, and later on, Moses, he tells him, you're going to die. I'm not going to let you go into the land, even though this is what all your life was about in the past 40 years. It gives us an idea, but God, who is not a respecter of persons, God, who is a jealous God, that those who dishonor him, he is not going to let it go through, even though those people may be his greatest servants. You see, our God is a consuming fire, as we read here and there. You see, and it is a fearful hand, you know, thing to fall into the hand of the Eternal. And a lot of people are taking the word of God very lightly. And that's what he said here, you have rebelled against my word. And the majority of the people of Israel, unfortunately, an awful lot of the people who call themselves the people of God are in that state of mind. And they don't even realize it. And they don't realize what kind of a fate is awaiting us. And God gives us an example. He's not a respecter of persons. If he'd done it to Moses and to Aaron, how much more us who are not in that on that level? So we should learn to, you know, to serve God with fear and trembling. As God says in Isaiah 66, even though I created the heaven and the earth, you know, you cannot impress me with any house that you're going to build or any great work that you're going to have, whatever it may be, or any great sacrifices, you know, that we're willing to give for him. You know, all that does not impress him. What impresses him, he said, is a person that fears him and trembles at his word. We're not that kind of people. Everything we do is in vain. And God wants us to have great respect for his word and not take it lightly. And a lot of people have this attitude, well, I don't think that's necessary for salvation. And Moses couldn't say that. You see? Well, you see what happened to Moses and Aaron for not taking the word of God seriously. And that's the way God regarded it. Rebellion. How many of us want to be brought before the judgment seat and brought to justice and to judgment for all these things that we said, well, that's not necessary for salvation, or, you know, I don't think that's important, or that's just opinion, your opinion, whatever it may be. No fear, no trembling at the word of God. A lot of people, unfortunately, don't have that spirit in them. And so that's what God is saying to Aaron. And the same thing is to Moses. You have rebelled against my word at the waters of Meribah. And then he says to Moses, take Aaron and Eleazar his son and bring them up unto the Mount Hor. And that's at the border of Edom there, in the south, east of the Negev. And strip Aaron of his garments and put them upon Eleazar his son. Now you can imagine the emotional scene that Moses had to go through in Aaron. Now here is Aaron standing there and he's still alive. And he could still go on. And yet, you know, his brother comes and both of them realize what they've done, you know. It must have been an extremely emotional scene, you know, for them, and also for God to see that, but he was not about to compromise, because God would never compromise with sin, no matter what. You see? He had to give the sacrifice of his son. He could not compromise with sin. Just say, oh, well, just forget all about it. You see? No. He had to come and give his life. And this very one that is giving the instructions here to Moses, he himself had to go through that. Much worse than that. And he could not compromise with sin. And he had to be obedient unto death. To his Father. To the Most High. And if we think that he did it for us, we're wrong. We must do it too. He didn't do it for us. You see? He does his part. We must do our part. He's not going to do our part for us. And that's why he commanded his people. Be you faithful unto death. A lot of people are not willing to do it. Only when things are nice, they're willing to go along with it. And when things get tough, they take off. They want to do their own thing. And so, his poor Moses and Aaron are standing there, and Eliezer, and everybody's extremely emotional about it. But, you know, they have to control themselves also at the same time. They're standing before God. They cannot, you know, make a big scene there. And so they had to go through that and bite their lips. And Moses began to strip his brother Aaron of his outer garments, and he put them on Eliezer, his son. And he said, this is what you do. And Aaron shall be gathered unto his people and shall die there. And as soon as he takes his clothes off, basically tells Aaron, you go sit down there, lie down, just close your eyes, and that's it. You're gone. I can imagine what Aaron goes through, what his brother goes through, what his, you know, his son goes through when all that is happening. So that should teach us a lesson to fear our God, for he is a consuming fire. Not to walk before him lightly. And a lot of people have absolutely no respect for him who call themselves people of God. You see the way they come to services. They do not know that they stand before the great king when they come before him. None of them would ever dare appear that way, the way they do before God. You know, when they go to the office of a mayor, much less the office of a governor, much less the office of the president of the United States. And look how they do it every Sabbath day. That shows contempt. You see? No respect, no honor, no fear, no reverence to God. And to their own shame, they're doing it. You know, they come with filthy garments from God's point of view. And God commands us, when we appear before him, to sanctify ourselves, wash our clothes, put in our own nice attire. You know, as he commanded the high priest, he told him exactly what to wear. Clothing of glory. You see? Not cheap rags, you know, or old things, something you wear, you know, every day, and totally disrespectful manner. A lot of people are that way, and if they wear nicely, you know, oftentimes their kids don't, you know, they just come with whatever, you know, things they have, they wear any day, and no respect, no honor. They don't teach them the fear of God either. And so they grow up to be the same kind of people. And they think that they're pleasing the sight of God and they are the people of God. Well, maybe the people of God, like all the Israelites were, but, you know, they were rebel rousers all their life and had to be put to death or punished or exiled. So being people of God is no compliment. You see? That's meaningless. That's what Paul was saying. He's not a Jew, you know, that's just a Jew because, you know, he's born a Jew from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and he has genealogy and things like that. You see, the Jew is the one inwardly. You see? That's the same thing for us. The people of God are the ones inwardly. So we should not come in and pat ourselves on the back because we're being called the people of God. That's meaningless if we're not inwardly the people of God. And God is spirit, and therefore we must worship him in truth and in spirit, in fear and reverence and humbleness and meekness and humility. We don't have that. What do we have? And so this is what Aaron is going through now because of that rebellion against the word of God. And God was not about to forgive that. And how many of us are going to be placed in that condition or similar condition like that? We're going to see, so, you know, so to speak, the kingdom on the horizon. We're not going to be able to make it through. You see? Because we had no respect for God. We have rebelled against his word. As you read in Isaiah 20, God is going to bring his people Israel out of captivity, out of the concentration camps, out of Holocaust, out of all the horrible conditions in which they were for quite a while. Whatever that period of time is, and he's going to bring them to the land of Israel, that is to the border, not to the land, but to the border of the land of Israel, just like here it is with Aaron. And there he said he's going to sit to judgment face to face with them, and he's going to purge the rebels from the midst of his people. So they will see the border of the land, but they would not be able to enter into it, and he will tell them, you're going to die here in the wilderness. I'm not going to let you in. Even though you delivered them all this time. He's going to make an example out of it. And all the rest are going to fear and tremble and not take, you know, the glory and the honor of God lightly. So man, some of us are going to be in that category. If we do not learn and turn around and humble ourselves before God while it is still day, instead of hardening our heart. As Paul, you know, would quote David saying, today, you see, that's the time to do it, not tomorrow. It's too late tomorrow. And it was too late for Aaron and Moses to rectify what they've done at that point. Certain things you cannot go back and rectify. And so this is what is happening here. He says, you're going to die there. Well, and he died. As simple as that. And Moses did as the Lord commanded. He was not about to rebel at this time at his word. And they went up into the Mount Hor in the sight of all the congregation, and everybody knows what is happening. So you can imagine how they all felt. And here it is, by this time you are talking basically the overwhelming majority of the people that are standing here watching it is the second generation. You see, most of the rebels are already gone. But this time, this is almost the end of the 40 years. And Moses stripped Aaron of his garments and put them upon Eleazar, his son, and Aaron died there in the top of the mount. And Moses and Eleazar came down from the mount. And as the people of Israel look up there and see Moses and Aaron, that is Moses and Eleazar, come down, the new high priest, they know what happened. Aaron is gone. That's the end of the chapter. Didn't have to be that way. Could have been differently. You see? So, you know, things like that should teach us lessons and teach us humility and meekness and fear of God. And those who are wise are going to learn to do it, and those who are not are going to continue, just like we read last time, as God says in the book of Revelation, you know, those who want to be unholy, let them be unholy. If they want to be unclean, let them be unclean, and so forth, and filthy. But the people who are holy, who are the very elect, they should stay that way and not turn away from God. And so he came down from the mount, and when all the congregation saw that Aaron was dead, they wept for Aaron 30 days, even all the house of Israel. National mourning of the entirety of the nation. We're talking now about the second generation, who were more in tune with God, more humble, more fearful of God. You see, not like the rebel fathers, who mostly are all dead, and all at this time also fully aware of the fact why their fathers were dead, why they had to stick around for 40 years themselves in the wilderness. You see, they were above 20, 40 years, now they're in their 60s because of what their fathers had done. And so they learned the lesson, at least in their lifetime. They kept remembering that, and then unfortunately another generation arose after them, probably the third generation, that didn't remember any of that, as we read later on in the book of Judges. And so that's what happened here. And mind you, you don't see anything like that in terms of the weeping and the mourning about Miriam. And you know, that's something should teach us some fear of God. And we are now in chapter 21, verse 1. And the Canaanite, the king of Arad, that's in the south, because the Canaanites were up and down, and there were, you know, the whole land was called the land of Canaan, but actually was also called the land of the Amori. So it depends where you were and what part of the land you were. There were the Amorites, and there were, you know, several tribes of the same kind of people. And so the Canaanite, the king of Arad, and that's in the south near the Negev, who dwelt in the south, and that's what Negev means also, south, heard tell that Israel came by the way of Atarim, and he fought against Israel. So here the Canaanites are not afraid. On one hand, they're afraid of Israel. On the other hand, you know, they think, you know, either we fight them or they'll kill us. And so they go and fought against Israel and took some of them captive. Why would God allow that? Well, obviously, you know, Israel needs still to learn a little lesson. Some of them were not still all the way where they should be. They were not with the program, so to speak, as some people would say today. And God allowed it. You see, whenever things like that happen, there is a reason. You have to look for the context, for the reason behind it. God was not asleep. And he does not allow the, you know, the righteous just to fall into mischief for nothing. And so, this is what happened here. They took some of them captive, and Israel vowed a vow unto the Lord. So they're not dedicating themselves to God. You see? They're not, you know, they cannot take God for granted. And so they dedicate themselves to God. They made a vow and said, if you will indeed deliver these people into my hand, then I will utterly destroy their cities. And this is what he commanded them to do to begin with, and their forefathers refused to do it. So now they're being put, you know, into test to see whether they're going to do it. And that's the way God worked it out. And so they stood up and were counted. And obviously, God was going to listen to them because they had done His will. Verse 3, and the Lord hearkened to the voice of Israel and delivered up the Canaanites, and they utterly destroyed them and their cities, and the name of the place was called Hormah. Destruction. Now, this is exactly what happened before that. In the first generation that came out of Egypt, when God told them to go into the land, you know, the spies were sent over there, and they came back and they refused to go into the land. You know, they incited them, scared them, and then put fear in their hearts and minds, and so they rebelled against God. And so God said, well, you're not going to go into the land. You're going to stick around for 40 years. And now they woke up and said, oh, no, we're going to go into the land. And so they went up there. Moses told them, hey, God is not with you. Don't go there. So the Amalekites came down from the mountain and the Canaanites, and they smote them. And the place, you know, that where they smote them was called Hormah, the same place. You see? Only this time is 40 years later. And this time it's the other way around. Now it's the Israelites who are obedient now, the second generation, who fear God, who vow to God, who dedicate themselves to God in the very place where their forefathers were defeated 40 years earlier by the Amalekites and the Canaanites. Here they defeated all these people there and totally destroyed them. You see? And this word is very important to remember, because that's the very word that God later on used in terms of our generation, where He said through Malachi in the last few verses, remember the law of Moses, my servant, which I commanded unto him in Horeb, and the statutes, you know, for all of Israel, you see. And if you don't, at the end of the passage he says there, if you don't remember that, I'm going to bring utter destruction. Cherem, same word for ma, cherem. In other words, I'm going to bring utter destruction on you. And that's what we see here. When they obeyed God, He brought utter destruction on their enemies. When they disobeyed God, He brought destruction on them. And this is what's going to happen to every single one of us. If we do not obey the voice of God from the heart, all the way, with fear and trembling. And God is not a respecter of persons. And then verse 4 we read, and they journeyed from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea. So now they're down there. The Aqaba, what it's called today, and then the Elat, you know, further up. You go up there, and they're more closer there to Elat. And that's the Dead Sea. Red Sea, well, Red Sea, that's a terminology that was given later. This is in English. In Hebrew, it doesn't say Red Sea. It says Yam Suf, the Sea of Reed. Later on, it was called the Red Sea, and most people don't even know why. You see, they don't have very little knowledge of history. Who was Edom? What was Edom? Edom was the brother of Jacob, and Edom was called Red because of the red porridge that he gave him, you know, the lentil soup. And so wherever he went, that's what they called him, Edom, Red. And so he dwelt by the Red Sea. And then migrated down into the areas of Saudi Arabia there, areas that are called today, you know, where the cities are, Medina and Mecca. All the territory was Edomite, and that was their kingdom. All the way down to Yemen, Teman, that's one of the sons of Edom. And then up to Shikdoms, you know, there are some Gulf states, and Iraq, to the land of Edom. That's where they are. Iraq is one of the chief nations of Edom. That's why you see that animosity, unbridled hatred that they have without cause against Jacob. Not only Jacob in the Middle East, but also Jacob in other countries in the West. So what you see there in the Persian Gulf is not a coincidence. If you do not have the background, you really don't understand what's happening there, nor would you know what is going to happen in the future, because all those things were recorded. You see? And God is going to allow Iraq a measure of success against the Allies, and they're going to be in captivity. That's right, American soldiers, British soldiers, Canadian soldiers, you know, European, from Jacob, are going to be in captivity in Iraq, in Iran, in different places there in the Middle East, and out of those places, God is going to redeem them, as you read in Isaiah 11, the house of Joseph and the house of Judah. And, you know, the book of the law here tells you already an awful lot of details about it, but, you know, most people are blind, they don't know it. They don't study the Word of God as they should. And so this is what we read here. And they journeyed from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to compass the land of Edom. And the soul of the people became impatient because of the way. It's not an easy road. If they were allowed by Edom to go through the, you know, the king's highway, it would have been a shorter road and more pleasant. And so they had to go around. And they got impatient. And this is the second generation that just recently were given the victory by God. But still, carnal-minded people, you know, they're hungry and thirsty and tired, and, you know, desert, it's not a pleasant area to be in. And so they got impatient, and the people spoke against God and against Moses. Wherefore have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? Now this, of course, not all of them said that way, but there were still enough rebel rousers among them, and that's why before that, a few scriptures earlier we read, why God allowed the Canaanites to go and smite some of them and take some prisoners. You see, that spirit of rebellion was not totally gone because not all the generation that came out of Egypt died. You know, some of them are still around, so they continue their attitude and they infest, you know, the minds of their sons with it. And so you see, that element is still there. And so they're rebelling against God. And they say, well, wherefore have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no bread and there is no water. And our soul loathes this light bread. That's how they treated the bread of God. That's how the children of Israel to this very day, a lot of them have contempt for the law of God. They loathe it. That's how their forefathers felt about that physical bread that God gave them. And that's how they felt as time went by toward the spiritual bread that He gave them. You see? That's what God says. Unless you remember the law of Moses, instead of loathe it and have contempt for it, unless you remember it and obey it and walk in it and walk in fear in it, you're going to have utter destruction. God is not going to tolerate, you know, this kind of a spirit or an attitude among His people, regardless of who they are. And so this is what they do now. They complain. He said, there is no bread, there is no water. And our soul, you know, we just abhor this light bread, the manna. Well, what was God going to do with this kind of people, this kind of an attitude? They allow the devil to enter into them, the spirit of Satan and demons. Well, He's going to send the physical counterparts of those demons to afflict them. And this is what we read. And the Lord sent fiery serpents. That's what the devil is described as. A fire-breathing, you know, dragon. You see? Serpent. A devil. But fire comes out of his mouth. So He sends fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, and much people of Israel died. And the people came to Moses and said, we have sinned. Why not say that before that? You see? That's carnality. Only after we are punished, then we turn around. And so they say, we have sinned because we have spoken against the Lord and against you. Pray unto the Eternal that He take away the serpents from us. And Moses prayed for the people. He could have said, well, you deserve it. Get what you deserve. No, no. He prayed for them. And the Lord said unto Moses, make you a fiery serpent and set it upon a pole, and it shall come to pass that everyone that is bitten, when he sees it, shall live. So they have to acknowledge the reason why they had that attitude. That spirit of the ultimate serpent was in them. So that's how they were going to acknowledge their sin, by looking up to the serpent. It's not that the serpent is going to deliver them, it's just a piece of metal. You see, all that was symbolic. And until people are willing to look up and see the one that became a serpent for us, became sin for us, the Savior, the sacrifice, you see, the one that created us, there is no salvation for them. So this is what we read here. It's not just a physical thing. This is what the ultimate became. When the one that took it upon himself, all the sins and iniquities of Israel, of his wife, of his people, and of course all the rest of the world, then he was raised up like the serpent, as he himself later on said. So this is not a coincidence, you know, what is happening here. when God is giving them these instructions, He's already prophesying the manner in which He's going to deliver them by taking it upon Himself, and they'll have to look up to Him and acknowledge that they're responsible for those sins that He took upon themselves, and that only He can deliver them. And people who are not willing to do it will have no deliverance. It's as simple as that. And that's in essence, unfortunately, where a lot of people of Israel are today. They're not willing to accept it, be it, you know, the people of Judah or the people of Israel. A lot of people couldn't care less about that. That's why most people today are irreligious, even though they have this facade of, you know, faith in God. You see? But not real, true obedience to that God. They still loathe His bread, the manna that came from heaven. They have contempt for the law of God. A lot of people call themselves people of God. They have contempt for the law of God. You begin to talk to them about the law of God, immediately they won't talk about something else. They don't like it. That natural resentment comes out, and they don't know what serpent is in them that is causing them to feel that way and to act that way. Until we are willing to look up to the one that became the serpent for us, became sin, you see, and took upon it himself our iniquities, and then acknowledge that, you see, and accept his sacrifice for us, we're going to be in the same condition that many of the Israelites were. They died. And so this is what happens here. So this is what Moses had done. And so it came to pass. He said, it shall come to pass that everyone that is bitten, when he sees it, shall live. And Moses made a serpent of brass and set it upon a pole. Now, you don't make a serpent of brass in a couple of seconds. It takes a little while to do it. But he was going through that. And as long as he was doing it, people could continue to die. And the serpents continued to bite them. They had no savior. So it came to pass, he said, Moses had done that, made a serpent of brass and set it upon the pole. And it came to pass that if a serpent had bitten any man, when he looked unto the serpent of brass, he lived. What happens if he didn't look, didn't want to look? Well, he died. Now, what happens to people who to the end of days are not willing to look? Well, they too are going to die. That goes for every single one of us. And the children of Israel journeyed and pitched in Obot, and they journeyed from Obot and pitched at Iha-Avarim. And of course, in English, you know, they're totally butchered in all these names here that sound so weird and funny, you know, to somebody who speaks Hebrew and tries to read them in English. Anyway. We're not going to explain all the meanings of this because there's so many names here. For those who are interested and go deeper into that, you know, pick up a lexicon. Nowadays, I have good material on the internet where you can do that, and you know, you enrich your comprehension of what is happening there. And so they went to Iha-Avarim in the wilderness, which is in front of Moab. Now they're going higher and higher. You see, north toward Moab, which is closer, which is above the Dead Sea now. Toward the sun rising. Sun rising means the east. You know, as the sun rises, that's from the east. From thence, they journeyed journeyed and pitched in the valley of Yered, or Zered, actually, valley of Zered. And actually, I don't know whether I said valley of Zered, because in Hebrew it says Nahal, which means a stream. Actually, the stream of Zered. Well, there was a Nahal, a stream, sort of a little river. There was also a nice valley around it, so they translated it to valley. That really doesn't make sense. Why say valley when it says a river, stream? Well, that's the nature of man. They just have to change things. And so, verse 13, we read, and from thence they journeyed and pitched on the other side of Arnon, which is another river, the river of Arnon, which is in the wilderness that comes out of the border of the Amorites. So you're going higher now. And the land of the Amorites was conquered and given to the tribes of Reuben and Manasseh, half Manasseh and Gad. And for Arnon is the border of Moab, between Moab and the Amorites. Wherefore it is said in the book of the wars of the Lord. And you know, there was a book called, and the name of the, you know, the name of the book was the book of the wars of the Lord. I don't know if we have everything preserved today. And obviously, much of what was written in this book probably was not preserved. On the other hand, many things that God saw fit were preserved, and that's what you see basically in the book of Joshua. Well, we're going to stop at this point. This is again Mordecai Joseph. Greetings all of God's people. Until next time.